You are listening to the Fretboard Journal 60th podcast. I am Fretboard Journal publisher Jason Verlinde. I'm very happy to say after only 3 or 4 years, we have found our intro and outro music. Our dear friend John Rauhaus, who plays pedal steel guitar and banjo for Nico Case, submitted the track that you're listening to in the background. It's called Homies Parade. You can get it on Amazon as an MP3, as well as other places where finer downloads are sold. John's got a bunch of solo albums out, in addition to being on most of Nico's records, and so we encourage folks to check those out, and a huge thanks to John for letting us pirate your music for a few seconds in the beginning and end of each podcast. This week, I am talking to John Grevin via the phone. John is a luthery legend based out of Portland, Oregon, where there are a lot of luthery legends. He is celebrating his 50th year of building instruments, believe it or not, and I wanted to just kind of touch base with him about how he has been so prolific over those 50 years. Most guitar makers I know who are working by themselves are making 10 or 12 guitars a year. John has finished his 2000th instrument, or is about to finish it. So I just kind of wanted to talk to him a little bit about that. We are going to delve a little deeper into John's career in a forthcoming Fretboard Journal. So if you haven't subscribed to the magazine, we encourage you to do so. We are also on the iTunes newsstand. If you have an iPad, you can get the Fretboard Journal downloaded to that. It's a little cheaper than the print subscription, but we, of course, encourage you to check out the print version, too, because there's a lot of cool stuff in there. We are going a little bit overboard on the podcast for the rest of 2012. In addition to John, who we'll be talking to today, I've got podcasts with the Wood Brothers, Seattle guitar legend Kurt Block, who was in the Fastbacks, Frank Young, and David Lasky, who just did this incredible illustrated Carter Family graphic novel, will be on a podcast coming up. And a bunch more. Luke Doucet, gosh, we have a ton of podcasts coming up, so we'll be doing those every week. We also have a bunch of great videos coming on to fretboardjournal.com, so please check those out if you haven't yet. Fretboard Journal 27 with Kim Thayil from Soundgarden, Jim Merrill of Merrill Guitars, Fred Frith, Loudon Wainwright III, a whole bunch of other great stuff is coming out just in a week or so. So if you haven't subscribed to the Fretboard Journal yet, please do at fretboardjournal.com. And without further ado, here's our conversation with John Grevin. First off, I guess I need to congratulate you. 50 years of instrument building.
Awesome. Insane.
Yeah.
My dad kept saying, are you serious? Guitar making? You can't make a living making guitars. Eventually, I won him over, though. It took about 20 years.
Well, the staggering thing besides just, building for 50 years is you're doing your 2200th guitar?
2200th instrument.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, it's 1976 guitars.
All right, who's counting?
I built a bunch of banjos and harpsichords and mandolins and other things too.
How the heck are you so prolific?
I just work my butt off.
I mean, that's it. It doesn't take a calculator to think that's around 40 instruments a year. And
I was doing about 60 a year for the first 15 years or so.
Really?
I had help. I did have one guy helping me, and then when he quit, I just kept on doing it because I was used to it by then.
That's crazy. A lot of builders.
Well, I do them in batches.
Yeah.
I don't just build one at a time, obviously. I'm doing like, the least I do is like 4 at a time, and generally it's 6 and sometimes even more. I've got 10 of them going right now.
Yeah.
And it's because there's so much downtime between various operations, you might as well fill up that space with useful work.
Sure.
And so, if you're making parts, you might as well make a dozen sets of parts versus one.
Sure.
Since I don't have or believe in CNC machines, I have to make each thing basically by hand with simple tooling. So it makes sense to make that one setup and do the operation, just make piles of parts for the future.
Yeah. When you do batches, do you make just, these are just going to be triple O's, or are you just sort of,
no,
it can be anything?
Kinds. Everything from Prairie States to single O 12 frets.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what's fun about it is even though they're guitars, each one's different. And they behave differently, and they're structured slightly differently, and I have to think about them differently because of the body sizes and the scales and all that stuff. To me, every instrument is an individual, regardless of how many I have going.
Yeah.
And every moment I work on that particular instrument, I'm thinking about the particular order, the customer, what he's told me about what he does, how he wants this thing to sound and feel and play. I think that's important. It's not just another guitar.
Definitely. Well, we have a story coming up with you in the magazine, I'm happy to announce. But
I don't need publicity, but I'm happy for it.
On that note about your customers, I know a sizable amount of your customers are actually in Japan, not in America.
Yes, I have a huge presence in Japan. I've been in Japan since 1974.
How did that happen?
I was working for George, and Hiroshi Tomita, who had a shop in Kobe, was buying instruments from George, mostly vintage stuff. And he came to Nashville, and he spent a week in Nashville with George and hung out in the shop and saw my work and saw that I was actually building guitars. And he said, I would like to have an exclusive contract with you to have guitars sent to Japan. And I thought and thought about it, and okay. It took me about 10 seconds. And so I signed this 15-page pink papered contract, and off we went. And I built guitars for him at first about 6 a year, and then a dozen a year, and some years I was up to over 20 a year. Wow. I mean, literally, he would have taken everything I built, I think, at one point, as will other dealers in Japan. And part of it is the Kobe shop was the epicenter in Japan. He was like the Gruen of Japan, so all the best players hung out there. And one of them, a Mr. Nakagawa, was kind of the Chet Atkins of Japan. And he bought one of my J herringbones, Maple J's, and then he bought another one, and then he bought an F, and then he had like 7 of my guitars at one point. And he was teaching all these younger people to play sort of finger style in Japan. And so they bought guitars, and on it went. And that was in 1974, and by the early 1980s, I was just backed up to the wall with these orders from Japan. And then one of his best students, Kotaro Oshio, who finished with him, I don't know, about 8, 9 years ago, went on to become a rock star of finger-picking guitar in Japan and all over the Southeast Asia.
Wow.
And he's got like 8 or 9 of my guitars at this point. He loves them. And so, of course, everywhere he goes, I go, and there's more sales.
So
I just went totally overwhelmed. I have no idea what I'm going to do.
So the phone is, when the phone rings, you never know where it's going to be coming from.
No, I sell all over the world. Sweden, England. I've got orders for England right now. I'm trying to get done. And France and Singapore and Taiwan and China. I've actually sent guitars to China. I got a call. Hello, this is Mr. Graven. Yes. Calling from Beijing. And I said, yeah, right. He said, no, really. He wanted to order a guitar. And after that, had several of his friends ordered guitars. So, I mean, just it's wild.
Yeah.
The internet gives me instant access to the entire planet and vice versa.
I want to talk more about your history than what you're up to now and some of your thoughts, but how do you kind of tap into a customer's mindset when there's obviously some cultural and language differences?
Generally, they have a really good idea of what they're after.
Okay.
And without getting into the major cultural differences between, say, here in Japan, they think iconically, and Kotaro Oshio is like an icon to them. So what he plays is what they want. So I could basically build like his basic dreadnought with the bird inlays forever, and they would take just that. So okay. It's my job kind of to introduce slight changes and offer them, here's a little difference of looking at this kind of thing, and over time sort of educate them in other opportunities.
Yeah.
And it's taken me years to do that, but now I'm building triple O's and single O's, double O's, and all kinds of things for Japan, as opposed to just that one dreadnought.
Well, you mentioned...
I mean, building that thing is like literally like falling out of bed. I could do it blindfolded at this point.
You mentioned...
But I love it. I love it.
Yeah. You mentioned George Gruen, and I want to go back in time a little bit.
Yeah.
Where...
I owe my career to George, really.
Well, let's talk about that. Where were you when you first encountered George in terms of your building career and location-wise even?
Okay, well, I'd been building guitars in Ithaca, New York in the late 60s and decided to move to train with somebody and move south since I was born in Birmingham, and that's kind of where a lot of my roots are. Mm-hmm. And a good friend of mine, a customer of mine, it was a good friend of Mike Longworth, who lived in Chattanooga at the time. So he said, well, good, call Mike and see what he's, see if he knows anybody in that area. And I did, and he was real nice, and he knew a guy named Johnny Davis who had a well-known repair shop in the Chattanooga area, and I called Johnny, and we set it up, and I moved to Chattanooga and spent about a year and a half with Johnny. That's where I kind of learned shooting lacquer and neck sets and some other things that were kind of basic, but mostly I was just doing inlays and custom work and repairs. And George would wander in periodically because George was always out and about looking for instruments, and Johnny knew the entire area of Chattanooga, the Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, and he had this finger on the pulse of all the vintage instruments. So George would come through the shop and ask, well, what have you seen lately, kind of thing. So George would come by and he'd look over my shoulder and see my work, and his persistent comment was, I could really use somebody like you in Nashville. And I said, George, I'd like it here. I love Chattanooga. I'm playing in a band. I'm having fun, making some decent money. And this went on for about a year, I guess. And finally, Randy Wood, who was working with George at the time, decided he was going to set up his own thing at the Pickin' Parlor around the corner from George's. And George needed somebody to replace him. So then George was really insistent. He said, I really need you to come to Nashville, and here's the financial arrangement, and I'll take care of you. I'll make sure you get all set up and everything. And by then I was realizing that the repair end of Chattanooga was kind of a dead end for me, so I decided that the Nashville move would be a good one. I was still reluctant. I mean, it's a big city to me, but my goodness, what an opportunity.
So I'm guessing we're now in the late 60s here. You must have been exposed to just almost every legendary instrument known to mankind.
Well, between 70 and 74, 5, okay. That was true. George, I think GTR, which is the George Tut Randy Consortium,
yep,
was set up, I think, in 68 or somewhere in that period. In fact, one of the pictures I sent you, the very first picture, was George at Galax.
Yeah.
And that was 1966 or 7, and he's on his own at that point. I could tell you all George stories all day long.
But, yeah.
And that's the George I knew.
Yeah.
One of the strangest dudes I'd ever met, but fascinating.
Of course.
Just a genius, absolute genius. I don't know if you know this, he has a photographic memory.
Yeah.
He literally walked up to me one day in the shop and said that he needed a 5-string banjo neck replica of a George Van Epps banjo.
Uh-huh.
I looked in our huge pattern book and I said, George, we don't have a pattern for that. And he sat down with a piece of paper and a pen and drew me to scale that pattern from memory. Blew me away.
So what were you mainly doing at George's shop at that point?
All kinds of repairs and restorations, custom building people would want. Well, Bo Diddley guitar was a custom order. The George Harrison, slide guitar was a custom order.
Yeah.
I was doing a lot of inlay work for people and just all kinds of finish work.
And then when did you part ways with Grün?
Well, it was a slow transition. And George was very helpful in that. He encouraged me to set up my own shop. And when he moved around the corner to the brick building on the multi-story building on Broadway,
He
let me lease the shop we were in at the time, the GTR on 4th Avenue. So I had this huge shop all to myself, and I just had benches everywhere, and I just laid it all out and started production right then and there.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 66. And then by 67... I'm sorry, 76.
Yeah.
And by 77, my wife and I decided to move away from Nashville because we just had a child, and we didn't think Nashville was a good place to raise her, and in part because one day, one of her first words was, Daddy. I said, uh-oh, we're in trouble. We're moving. So we moved from there to Nashville, Indiana.
But
I was working at the old GTR shop until the end of it.
What?
I was also doing banjo necks and stuff for George at the time to help pay the bills. George is very sweet and very supportive. I mean, I couldn't ask for more.
Tell me about, over the last 50 years, some of the instruments that have crossed your desk or workbench that have really stood out to you as being kind of the pinnacles.
Oh, Well, most of them were at Grunz.
Yeah.
And literally, we had a rack full of 30s vintage Martins and Gibsons. So some of the best instruments of any kind on the planet. So I got I got to personally restore, like, Red Smiley's D45,
mm-hmm.
Charlie Monroe's D45, and one other late pre-war D45. And those three guitars in particular were just mind-bogglingly good. I've never played an instrument that sounded like that. They were like, it was like sitting down to a 9-foot Busendorfer.
Mm-hmm.
Every single note was absolutely solid. It was woody. It was strong. It was powerful, but it was clean and it was complex. It was everything you want out of any instrument, really. And no other guitars that I played, even amongst all the Herringbones and the D18s, came close to that. So those were kind of iconic instruments. And that's what set the thing in my mind of, how come nobody's building stuff like this anymore?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a guitar. It's wood parts. They all go together the same way. And why don't our guitars sound like that? So that's when I started to really pay attention to the instruments that came through my hands and took notes and pictures and whatnot and kind of archived in my head the differences in the structure over the span of instruments that I saw. But those D45s were just awesome.
Have you been able?
I'd love to sit down with every guitar maker in the country, hand one of those guitars, say, "Play this. What do you think?"
Yeah.
It would change the minds.
Yeah.
It also drive people crazy trying to achieve that. That's Len Dudenbosel or Wayne Anderson.
Have you been able to revisit any of those guitars that you may have saw 40 years ago to see how they've held up?
No.
No?
My guitars are the Martins.
The legendary ones, the Martins. Like,
no.
Yeah.
No, almost all of them went overseas.
Yeah.
And I could tell you a sad story about the 45 from Red Smiley's, but you wouldn't want to know what happened to that guitar.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, it's no longer a guitar. It's not really a guitar anymore. It's a disaster.
It's an ashtray. No.
Well, no, it went to a Japanese collector who had no concept of what this object was. For him, it was just an investment.
Yeah.
He put it in a glass case in a room with 16% relative humidity.
Uh-oh.
And within a few years, it just totally disassembled.
Crazy.
It was just a nightmare. So no, I haven't actually.
Yeah. Well,
I'm assuming most of them are still intact and great instruments.
You know,
so much of those great instruments are off the market. They're unavailable for the average person to pick up and play because they're so valuable now.
Sure.
Which is sad because you've got to hear these old guitars to get some idea of what's possible.
Yeah. You know, talk to me a little bit about how you as a builder both then and now try to achieve that sort of iconic sound from these guitars from the 30s. At the time you were picking these instruments, you know, Martin and Gibson in the 70s weren't really making guitars anywhere close to their construction
that
techniques.
That was part of why we were able as hand builders to get into the market.
Yeah.
Because we could consistently build better instruments than the factories were putting out. That was a dark time for Martin and Gibson. Very dark.
Was it obvious to you as a builder with obviously some skill set, this is how it should be done, or was there kind of a cracking of the code that you had to figure out?
The cracking of the code is an ongoing thing.
Yeah.
But even then, I knew that these instruments were special. And if you model your instrument with that in mind, it should be somewhat comparable. Turns out, not quite true, because there's, you know, 80 years of hard playing on these instruments as well. But over time, constant tweaking of top thicknesses and materials and bracing and all the stuff that goes into making up a guitar, it'll get very close to those old sounds.
Mm-hmm.
But it took me at least 500 guitars to get to a point where I had some understanding of it.
Interesting.
I may be a slow learner, I don't know, but it just took a lot of instruments going through my hands, working with lots of different materials and brace sets and whatnot to figure out what kind of got as close as I could get to that sound. Now it's pretty easy. I can do it fairly consistently.
Yeah.
But part of that, there are different materials on the market now that sort of replicate the old Adirondack that Martin used, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't true back in the 70s and 80s. You basically had Sitka and Engelmann and some German.
But, you know, I know you're a traditionalist in the sense that you don't want to use a CNC, but you also don't always use hide glue, for instance.
No, I do it on request. I used to use it all the time at Gruen's for repairs and restoration. It's fun. It's great. It's like old-fashioned crazy glue. It's very quick with hot hide glue.
Yeah.
But you got to be ready to work because it's fast. There's no thinking about it. You just have to know where things go and put them there. So in that sense, it's a challenge. I love the challenge of it. But
yeah.
In terms of function,
yeah.
Modern glues work just as well, and I honestly hear absolutely no difference. There's a lot of mythology about that, and I think it's partly marketing, but there really isn't, I don't think, a note worth a difference between high glue and the modern white aliphatics.
Are there other instances where you may stray from a 1930s Marden in construction because ultimately you don't think it makes an impact?
I actually do a whole series of different constructions depending on what the customer wants.
Okay.
I do fewer true vintage reconstructions than I do, say, sort of hybrids of vintage and modern.
Yeah.
Because most players don't want... Honestly, if you played a bunch of the old 30s Martins, a lot of them aren't very interesting. They're very fundamental. They're very muddy almost. They don't have articulation, but they got tons of power. And as John Calkin says, give them loud and they'll think tone. It's kind of that way. So I do a whole range of different voicings on the top.
Yeah.
And generally, like for Japan, they want a relatively modern sound. They want lots of sustain. They want that crystalline clarity. So I build a very different structure for them than I do for, say, somebody who wants flat, big bluegrass.
Sure. It's got to be interesting to be, you know, every guitar is different. You, it's a new challenge every time.
Every single time. I love it.
Do you
have... As I say, there's no end point to it.
Do you have a personal favorite
model?
You never
know enough. I'm sorry?
Do you have a personal favorite model?
Yes. I like the 00.
Yeah.
Short scale 00. I think it's the best all-around instrument for virtually any style of music. You can flat pick it, finger pick it, you can do jazz, you can actually do bluegrass if you're not embarrassed having a small guitar around your neck.
Sure.
And they have this tremendous focus. They're very powerful, but they're powerful in a different way than a dreadnought. Dreadnoughts tend to be sort of the thunder in the distance, and triplos are very focused, they're very balanced. But they throw the sound a little more efficiently than a dreadnought. For example, when Wayne Henderson played Portland a couple of years ago, I called him up ahead of time, and we had him over for dinner, the whole gang. They came over at 2 in the afternoon and started, you know, warming up and whatnot and getting ready for the gig and talking about repertoire. I said, Wayne, here, try this, because I know he's a triple O guy. And the guitar never left his hands. His guitar never got out of the case. He played it all afternoon and took it to the gig and played another 2 hours. Loved it.
Do you interact much with other builders?
Yeah, all the time.
You're kind of in a hotbed
in
Portland.
We email, we keep in touch.
Yeah. You're also supplying
the
cards.
Often it's just answering questions about stuff, or what am I doing with the finish these days, or is this bracing too big, or, you know, this kind of stuff. But some of these guys are just friends. We just chat.
Yeah.
How's it going? I love it. The guitar-making community is a community. It's not like the violin builders of the past where everything is closed-lipped and tight. Guitar makers share information left and right. In fact, Portland has at least a half dozen full-time builders, and we gather for lunch once a month just to chat.
That's great. What do you have apprentices?
I have over the past 25, 30 years. I've had about 8 of them.
Yeah.
But I don't have time.
Yeah.
I love to do it. I love the teaching aspect of it. It forces me to think about what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Actually think about it and articulate it as opposed to just flying on autopilot. But the teaching process interferes with the building process significantly. I mean, it slows me down by 2/3.
Yeah.
And with the current workload, I haven't got time.
How far out are you building?
2 years or thereabouts.
Yeah.
I usually build between 40 and sometimes 50 a year, so about 100 guitars.
I'm still...
I have steady orders. I have, like, order sheets from my Japanese guys. So they just, I just say, which one do you want? And they tell me, I want number 6 and number 7, kind of thing. And I build those guitars for them. But the individual orders fill in all the blanks with the what few dealers I have.
And then you have the pickguard business.
Actually, not.
Oh.
I don't make those anymore, technically. I set up a company in Bloomington, Indiana before I left, and they make the production stuff. They make hundreds of guards, and they do the LMI guards.
I had no idea.
I only do the, like, I did a run for Martin for the Roy Rogers thing because they couldn't find anybody else that had the right look, but that was the last sort of commercial run I did on these things.
Got it.
And I make my own. I make some for friends and local people, but I haven't got time. I'm building guitars. I got guitars after my navel here.
Are you ever going to be able to retire, or are you always going to be wanting to get back on the workbench?
Well, the joke amongst guitar makers, especially those long-termers, is retirement is face down dead on your workbench, a smile on your face, and a chisel in your hand.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of what I'm thinking. As long as I can do this, I'll keep doing it. I love it. It is more fun than any. It should be illegal. It's so much fun.
It's great to hear.
And challenging at the same time.
Yeah. Well, what if I were at your workshop in Portland right now, what guitar is on the bench? What are you building?
I've got two Brazilian triple O's, triple O 42 that I'm doing, and I've got a dreadnought that's going together later today. That's for Japan. And another dreadnought is going to a collector in Chicago. Really nice Brazilian on that one. And what else have I got in there? I've got a D18 style guitar going to Hong Kong. I've got an L00 going to Australia.
Okay.
What else have I got? Something else. It's a 0042 for Guitar Gallery.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, John,
variety.
Thank you so much. The story on you will be in early 2013 in the Fretboard Journal if folks want to check it out.
Excellent.
And thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Get back to
my
work.
Pleasure. I will do that right now.
All right.
Thanks.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.